Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
And welcome to Right Stream Tuesday, everyone. I don't sound like Daria, do I? I am your guest host, Diane Student, and I am filling in for your regularly scheduled host, Daria DiGiovanni. She's hanging out with family this evening, so you've got me. And who am I? Well, I am no stranger to the internet radio broadcasting field. I used to have my own show right here on Blog Talk Radio for about 5 years, the award-winning Freedom's Wing show, and that kind of broadened out into the Freedom's Wings radio network, and I had a show on there called Twilight Hour, which kind of focused on the paranormal from a biblical worldview and things that were unexplained and strange, and I had a guest on there who I liked so much that I thought I'd share him with all of you here in the Right Stream family. So that's who's going to be joining me this evening. I am an entrepreneur. I run my own small business, and I don't host the Freedom's Wing show anymore because it kind of got tired of doing the political thing. To me, politics is two things. It's poly, which is a lot, and ticks, which are blood-sucking creatures. And after a while, 5 years of it was enough for me, and I said, you know what? I'm going to follow my dreams, and one of those dreams is writing. So I am also a blogger and writer. As a matter of fact, today I just finished a huge goal for myself. For those of you who are familiar with the November National Novel Writing Month, you know about the NaNo competition that they hold. You're supposed to write a 50,000-word novel. They do this every November. Well, they kind of stretch that into something that also includes April and July, and they call it Camp NaNo, and it's a little bit less strict. You can kind of choose whatever you want to do if you want to write a small, you know, a short story or multiple short stories or just work on whatever you want. They're pretty open to it, but I decided I wanted to do the 50,000-word challenge, and today I validated my first novel, which had 51,025 words. So now I'm getting ready to do all the tearing it apart and revising and all that good stuff. But hopefully later on this year we will have out the book one in the Lewis Chronicles, The Shattering. So be watching for that. If you want to follow me, you can find me at twitter.com/intrepidstudent. So just think of an adventurous and my last name student, and you'll find me there. I also happen to be a cemetery explorer, a taphophile, to look at the history behind people who are there in the cemeteries and what have you. So if you want to check out my blog, it is wherehistorylies.com. All right. And also, if you would like to check out more about Right Stream Radio, you can find them at rightstreamradio.com. I know they have shows almost every day of the week right here on Blog Talk Radio, a lot of fabulous hosts, a lot of fabulous topics they have. So make sure you tune in to hear as often as possible. And this show is normally on at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Tuesdays. So mark that into your calendar as well. This evening, as I said, I am being joined by Bruce Hennigan. He is a Christian apologist and lecturer. He also is an author who is really ambitious. He's working on a 13-book series. He's got three of them under his belt and already out there. A fourth one is soon to be out. He's written both nonfiction and fiction, so we're going to talk about that this evening along with his book series. He also happens to be a doctor. And a couple of things that I would like to add on to who he is he's a journeyer to Hobbiton, which should be intriguing to some of you out there, and also a Doctor Who cosplayer. So lots of great stuff we're going to talk about this evening. I would like to welcome Bruce Hennigan.
Thank you, Diane. Thanks for having me.
The Right Stream Radio Show.
Oh, yeah, I wish I'm very excited to have you. I could pop in my TARDIS and be there with you, but...
Well, you know, if you hopped in the TARDIS, you might miss me because you might pop into some other year.
That's
that you were
right.
Really
you
meaning
know,
to hit.
We know how fickle the TARDIS can be. So.
Exactly.
You know,
you
it's funny you should mention NaNoWriMo because I participated in that, and that's where this my third book, The 11th Demon, which we're going to talk about tonight, that's where that book came from. It came from participating in NaNoWriMo one year. So that's kind
of
interesting.
Oh, awesome. No, I think it's a fabulous thing because it kind of, you know, you probably know this, it's really easy to procrastinate and get frustrated when you get into that middle territory, and so it kind of keeps you on track and makes you got to write something. Get down, sit down, and write it.
That's it, yes. That's right. And I was asked by my local Barnes & Noble store to come in, and they were doing a push for NaNoWriMo about 3 or 4 years ago, and they said, we just want you to show up and write a novel because you've got a published book. At that time, my first book is out, The 13th Demon, and I had the second and third book written, and I said, well, you know what? I'll come every Saturday from 10 to 2, and I'll sit down, and I'm going to write an in-between book between the second and third book to just for myself. Just so I'll know more about my characters, I can develop more of the story, and I decided to write it all from a first-person point of view from each one of my characters so I would get to know the characters better. And by the time I finished that novel at the end of the month of November, I said, okay, this is a keeper. And it became the third book in the series and scooted the third book to number 4. So it was it's a great experience. If you want to write, you need to do NaNoWriMo. I mean, it's just fabulous, so especially this new extended version that you're talking about. So,
well, very cool. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is I was following your adventures down there in New Zealand. I did say you were a journeyer to Hobbiton, and I'm so jealous because I've always wanted to go to New Zealand. Hopefully I'll do it in the future. What was that like?
Oh, my goodness. It was the trip of a lifetime. My wife met a lady online playing bridge, and she came to the States, and they became best friends. They Skype all the time, and her husband invited us down, and they met us at the airport in Auckland, and we piled into their minivan, and for 20 days we traveled all over New Zealand, the North and the South Island. And the highlight of the trip, I mean, of course, I'm a huge Tolkien fan, huge Lord of the Rings fan, and the height of the trip was to go to the Hobbiton movie set and to actually stick my hand in Bilbo Baggins' mailbox. and to sit in the chair where he had where he drank his ale in the Green Dragon pub, it was just unbelievably awesome. It was the whole trip was great, but visiting Hobbiton was like a dream come true. It was just incredible. So
I can imagine. Well, I did a little brief bio of you, but I would love for you to share with everybody else a little bit more about yourself, particularly since this is mostly a writing audience. What made you decide to become a writer, and when did you start writing?
Well, I grew up in the country. My mother and father owned 62 acres of pasture and wooded kind of forest, and I came along late in their life. My brother and my two sisters were already grown and married, so I had to use my imagination. That was my playmate. And my parents grew up during the Depression. They got married during the Depression and lived through World War II. And whenever they would get together with their relatives, who lived down in central Louisiana, like they would get together and shell peas and shuck corn, you know, when the garden was coming in, they would sit there and tell these incredible stories about what life was like during the 1920s and the 30s and the 40s, stories about like Bonnie and Clyde, you know, going through the Louisiana countryside and life during World War II. And so I grew up listening to these incredible stories. I mean, they were just so rich and detailed. And so at an early age, I wanted to write. I wanted to write my own stories, and I started writing when I was 13. In fact, my birthday present for my 13th birthday was a portable typewriter. So, I mean, you know, I didn't want a gun or a football, or I wanted a typewriter. And that's when I began to write, and grew up, you know, reading science fiction, comic books, in the golden age when the original Star Trek was on television, and all that inspiration. I've always loved to write. In fact, I can't not write. I have to write. It's part of my DNA, I guess. I have to do that. And it took me a long, long time to get published, but I've spent all of my life either writing dramas or writing short stories, and of course I've written a nonfiction book on depression, which we're doing an update on that. It's coming out in September, and then my real dream was this Jonathan Steele Chronicles, this series of fiction books I'm writing now. So, but I've always wanted to write. I kind of got sidelined going to college and medical school and becoming a doctor, but you know, I got back on course with my writing after that. So.
You got to love when somebody says, I got sidelined having to go to medical school and stuff.
It was kind of hard to – well, I did a lot of writing in medical school, but it was mostly, you know, in the middle of the night when you're tired and you've been up for two nights and you're trying to go to sleep. And I kept a little notebook, and I just wrote essays and thoughts about becoming a doctor. And one day I'd like to turn that into a book. I go back and I read that now, and it's just kind of incredible to go back to that thought process of what you were going through when you're in that process of becoming a doctor. It's very interesting, pretty grueling and dehumanizing at times, but the writing kept me sane and got me through that that tough time in my life. So,
well, that's great. And like you said, you're working on a 13-book series, which is really ambitious. I mean, most people, when they're, you know, thinking about writing multiple books, they shoot for a trilogy. What made you decide on 13?
Well, way back in the late 90s, I had finished the manuscript for a book called Conquering Depression, which was with my co-author Mark Sutton. It was published by Brodmann and Holman. That's the book we're updating in September. And you get into that mode of working on a book and finishing the manuscript, and I said, okay, I'm done with this. Now I want to write my novel. I want to write my fiction. And I couldn't find anything. Nothing came to mind. I was reading a lot of different books that summer, and finally, one night I said, you know, God, I don't know what you've got planned for me. I wrote this book on depression. Maybe that's the only book you ever want me to write. But I just turn it over to you. If you want me to write something in fiction, I need an idea. And literally, I woke up the next morning, 4 o'clock, with the story of the 13th demon. Just completely, it was there in my head. And I started writing at 4 o'clock in the morning, and by noon I'd written 6 chapters. And by the end of that month, 30 days later, I'd finished my first novel. And for some reason, the idea of the 13th demon popped into my head. I kept calling my villain the 13th demon. And so when I started shopping the book around, an editor said, are you going to write about the other 12 demons? And I went, 12 disciples, 12 demons. Oh, and then I could just see where I could take the story, and I created this idea of a council of darkness of 12 demons who throughout the centuries have been in league with human beings to carry out Satan's plans. And when I got that idea, I realized I could take my characters and I could grow them through, hopefully, through all 13 books and then tell the final story, because my main character, Jonathan Steele, has amnesia. And so part of his story, his journey, is recovering his past. So I outlined 13 books, 13 topics, 13 ideas, and if I get to do it, hopefully I'll get to write all 13 books. Depends on if I can sell them, you know, if people buy the first 3 books and the 4th book, which will hopefully be out in about 6 to 9 months. So,
well, I think you should write them all, just because I happen to be a huge fan. I've read the 13th Demon and the 12th Demon, and I'm getting ready to start on the 11th Demon. So you'll have to finish them at least for me.
Well, I'm going to finish them at least for me, no matter what. Even if I have to post them as PDFs and give them away on my website, I'm going to write the story because I'm passionate about it. I can't sleep at night. I think about my characters and where I'm going to take them. And of course, one of my passions is a defense of the Christian faith. And so what I do with each book is I talk about some evidence for the truthfulness of the Christian faith. And I work that into the story, kind of like, you know, Michael Crichton, who wrote all these great books, Jurassic Park and Andromeda Strain. He would always take a historical or a scientific idea, and he'd build a story around it. And that's kind of what I do with each one of my books. I take an idea or a concept that impacts the Christian faith, and I build a story around that concept so that hopefully you not only get an enjoyable, entertaining story, you learn something. You get a little bit of aha. Oh, I never thought that. I never knew that. And at the end of every book, I have a list of resources, you know, some books that I suggest that you read to kind of fill you in on a little bit more of these facts that I've discovered in my journey in the last few years through through learning how to become an apologist, and that's a bad word, but that's a defender of the Christian faith. So,
mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've come up with my own genre, which I think you would fit into, and I call the stuff that I write speculative faction.
Oh, I like that. I'm going to write that down right now.
A lot of what we write, and especially in your books, because of the material you're talking about, while there's people, I'm sure, that don't believe in demons and angels and all that other stuff, I do. And so it's like you take fact and you mix it in with a story that you've made up,
right.
And it's kind of fun to pull it apart and see where the real stuff is. So I'm glad that you add those resources
in
there.
Yeah, I like
that
term.
This
whole idea of speculative fiction is really popular right now, although the publishers don't quite know what to do with it, but they don't know quite how to push it or market it. But I think it's extremely popular among readers, and I like that idea, speculative faction. I like that. You might need to create a website for that. And
I might have to do it.
Yeah, speculativefaction.com, and then start promoting it. I know several good writers who write speculative faction. So, you know, one of my frustrations as a published author is being a part of a big publishing company's imprint, and then watching that implode with the economy, and then seeing seven or eight of my good friends who write this kind of fiction have to move on and find other publishers and other contracts, and look for an outlet, look for a place to market or do, you know, publicize their books, because they're excellent writers. So there's definitely a market out there, a group of us writers and readers who love this kind of fiction, and I just wish we could get a little bit more publicity for it, a little bit more awareness for it. Part of it is this wonderful blog, Talk Blog Radio, that we're doing. That's a great way to promote it, so I appreciate being a part of that.
Well, you know, so many people will ask you, well, what do you write? And I always hated labels and stuff, and it's so hard to be like, well, it's got science fiction, I guess, because some of it is kind of out there. And there's some fantasy, because there's some, you know, things that might seem like they're quote-unquote magical or something of that nature, and it could be in a world that doesn't actually exist. But it doesn't totally fit into all of that. So, I don't know. I just thought speculative faction was the best way to... Because things
don't always
fit into one thing.
You know, when you step back and look at what's going on in the movies and what's popular today on television with the Marvel Universe expanding, you get this. This is what people want now. They don't want a straight science fiction. They don't want a straight fantasy. It's got components of all of that mixed into it. You know, there's a bit of romance. There's a bit of science fiction. There's a bit of magic and fantasy. And I think that's what people enjoy. They don't want to be pigeonholed in one particular genre or subgenre. I think they enjoy having a little bit of each one of these elements, as long as the story is a good story and as long as it's cohesive and it makes sense and there's good characters. And I think it's very popular today. I mean, it really is. It's this type of a mixture of different genres. So.
Yeah, and I think it's because, and this is one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about, when you get into areas of the supernatural or the paranormal or unexplained kind of things, I think we're seeing a lot more of it out there, not only because, you know, paranormal shows seem to be the it shows in reality right now with, you know, the Ghost Hunters and Paranormal Witness and all this other stuff out there. But then you also have all the stuff going on with UFOs. And I think most people that you talk to nowadays, there's just so much talk about it that they believe there's something out there. They're not quite sure what it is. So I'm thinking that some of this is starting to feed into what you're talking about there, because people are starting to actually see it around them. It's not so much, oh, that's something that could never happen or isn't real. They're starting to look at it and going, well, maybe this is real, and that's what I like about what you've written in your books. Not only do you have what you're talking about there with unforgettable characters, but you have this story that is pretty believable, even though it is supernatural and fantasy and that kind of thing and speculative. There's a lot of realism there, too.
Right. I try to ground my stories in realism. You know, when you look back, one of the books that was kind of a turning point for me was The Da Vinci Code. And when I say that, I'm not necessarily being positive about it. When I read The Da Vinci Code, it was such a great writing and a great story. Mm-hmm. But what I saw was he took the facts and he took history and he twisted it to fit his story. And so as I'm reading this book, of course, being a Christian, it was deeply offensive to me, and I'm going, well, wait a minute, this is not historically, this is not how it happened. This is how he wants it to have happened. And that disconnect really ruined the book for me, you know. Of course, they turned it into mm-hmm. a movie with Tom Hanks and Ron, you know, Opie, Ron Howard directed it. I mean, it's got to be true, right? So, and that for me was, okay, when I write my books, I want to make sure that even though it seems fantastical, even though there's some really almost fantasy or some supernatural elements to it, it's grounded in real things, that real people, real events, reality, and in truth. Because at the root of it, that's what we're looking for in life, is truth. You know, we are looking for truth. Everybody is searching for truth. And in a culture that no longer believes that the God of the Bible represents absolute truth, we're grasping at straws and picking poor substitutes out of all of this fantasy and science fiction to try to find truth. That's why it's so popular, because we're just thirsting for a sense of the divine, a sense of this transcendental truth or transcendent truth that's out there. And so ultimately I think you have to bring people back to, and that's why I use apologetics, back to some kind of firm foundational truth that has evidence for it, that you can rely on, that you can begin to plug into your life and build upon that to, you know, so that you have a truthful foundation for your very existence, for the way you look at reality, the way you, what we call your world view, the way you look at the world. So, wow, that was a really deep little thing there, wasn't it? I didn't mean to get so philosophical, but...
Well, that's what makes people great writers. I mean, I don't know if you do this, but I feel like there's a little bit of me in every character I write, and some of the things come out of their mouths, I'm like, that was me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, people ask me, my main character, Jonathan Steele, is this angry, violent man who's lost his memory, but he remembers becoming a Christian, and that just rubs him the wrong way, because it's not, his nature seems to be so different, and he can't understand why he's so, you know, he has no context for why he is the way he is. And people ask me, well, are you like that? Well, no, I avoid conflict. I'm a peacemaker. I hate to get in arguments with people. But I guess there's this inner part of me that wants to be like that, you know, that wants to be able to get into somebody's face and punch him out or push him away. And, you know, so I think you're right. Every character I write, there's something in that character that it may be a hidden desire of myself. It may be a part of me that I have yet to explore. So I think you're absolutely right. And a lot of my characters I base on friends and relatives. So that's kind of interesting when they go, did you base this character on me? Well, no, not really. Yeah, I did.
I guess you're okay as long as you don't, like, kill them in the book.
Right.
Well, that's what's fun about your characters, too, and very interesting, is even some of the characters, like Raven is one of my favorite characters, and she normally would be considered, on the surface, if you watch her, she's a villain. And yet
exactly.
You get inside of her, and we start to see that what makes her tick, why she's become who she's become, some of the horrors that she had to endure as a young child. And, you know, you have characters that are in this crisis of faith, which is, you know, a hard place to be when you are facing, you know, demons from the pit of hell. You don't really want to be having a crisis of faith. And I know that you have expressed at times that you've endured that. Is that some of what you're relating through some of these characters?
Oh, yes. I grew up in the church. I grew up in a Christian environment. But when I got out into the real world, I began practicing medicine. I had some of my colleagues just confront me with really tough questions, and I couldn't answer them. I mean, like, you know, who does God think he is? Why is there evil in the world? I mean, there's a whole bunch of questions that are asked, and I just didn't have coherent, rational answers for them. And that really made me stop and say, why do I believe what I believe as a Christian? And then, in fact, what is it I believe? And that little bit of question began, it produced in me a really deep crisis of faith that I think had something to do with some medication I was taking and made me a little psychotic. And since then, they've taken that medicine off the market. But But I had this kind of break from reality where I couldn't feel God. It's like, where is he? It happened at the beach in Gulf Shores, and I talk about that in my depression book. But it just really, it was horrifying. For about 5 or 10 minutes, it's like I couldn't feel God. It was like everything that I didn't want to believe, that we're just here by chance, that there's no God, all of that became real. And then it all reversed itself. But it left me asking the question, God, are you real? And I made a really big mistake, which in retrospect was not a mistake. I said, God, prove you're real to me. And over 6 years of crisis and tough times and really bad things and a deep depression, I became to realize that God is real. And during that time, I looked at all religions. I looked at all belief systems. I tested them. I read about them. I examined them. And at the end of the day, I came back to the Christian faith through an organization called Reasons to Believe, which is a science faith think tank. They had answers for some of these tough questions that was rational and reasonable and had good evidence behind it. And it was like I wept when I began to read a book called The Fingerprint of God by Hugh Ross. Great book. And then he had a book called The Creator and the Cosmos. And as I began to read those books and realize, you know, there's strong evidence that the God of the Bible is the creator of the universe, and I can put my faith in him, and there is truth in this world. There are absolutes, and it's not just a fantasy. It's not blind faith. It's based on the evidence. And so suddenly my faith began to grow and become stronger. And I had looked at everything and came to this conclusion, tested everything, and the only thing that fell out as true was my belief in the triune God of the Bible. So it was a very trying time. So a lot of that turmoil and crisis that I went through, I can bring to my characters, because I think all of us have those questions. I mean, if you haven't questioned your faith, whatever you believe in, then your faith is going to be weaker because of that. And so when I think that's what I bring to these characters, is I can tap into that deep, dark depression. I can tap into that incredible, deep loneliness. I can tap into that feeling of complete isolation and abandonment. And then I've got the perspective, though, of being on the other side of that valley of darkness, you know, the shadow of death, and looking back to where I was and seeing how I came out of it. And so I have hope now, and so I can bring to these characters the light in the darkness and show that they have hope and grow them and redeem them. It's interesting you mentioned Raven. I don't want to give too much away about the second book, but you know what happens to her if you've read it. And I'll just tell you this little spoiler. You haven't seen the end of Raven, so...
Yay!
And she'll be back, and she may come back in book number 5. Let's just put it that way. So you haven't seen the end of her. So, and of course, I gave a little epilogue in that book where you realize you haven't seen the end of her. I don't want to give too much away, but she's such a great character. I mean, she started out as just a one-note villain, but as I've delved into her character and began to work with her and her background, I said, I just can't. She's got a... We can't just throw her away. She's just too good of a character. So she'll be back in some future version of the book, so hopefully. So anyway, that was a lot of stuff.
Well,
I'm
goodness.
Sorry I kind of rambled on that.
No,
but,
that's all right.
So.
Well, I enjoy that you want to get into the mind of, you know, there are people out there that are just pure evil. But a lot of the time when we see somebody who's done something that we think is an evil act, when you dig into their past and whatnot, you see what's made them who they are. It doesn't give them an excuse for who they are.
Yeah,
but I think
you're
it
right.
helps us to maybe understand a little bit of why they've become whatever they have become.
Yeah, I think at every point in each person's life, we make choices and we make decisions that take us down our pathway either to goodness or to light. I mean, to darkness and evil, I mean, it happens. And those choices are influenced by our environment, by our family, by our friends, by different things. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's a choice that we make. And that also means that there's a point where you can choose to do good again, where you can turn away from that. Of course, that's the whole foundation of the Christian faith, that you can turn away from that brokenness back to a state of forgiveness and love. Of course, I do talk about in the second book this idea that, you know, the 12th demon I talk about, is there the unpardonable sin? Is there a point of no return? Can you become so evil that you are so corrupted and so you've just really dug yourself so deep into a hole of evil that you're beyond redemption. Is that even is it possible to do that? And I deal with that topic in that second book, The 12th Demon. And it makes you wonder when you look at people like Adolf Hitler and other historical figures who were just so incredibly evil. Did they just go so far that there was just no hope for them? There's no way they could ever be good again. And that's an interesting topic when you talk about good and evil. So,
sure. Is there a point where there is no more redemption for you?
Right, right. Almost
well,
where
you
become
interesting.
Pure evil.
It's interesting the route that you decided to go with these books, because when you talk about the genre of Christian horror, which this would kind of fall into there a little bit, getting into the supernatural, there's not a whole lot of authors out there. I know when we spoke previously, I'd mentioned that I had always been a fan of Frank Peretti.
Right.
And, boy, he was kind of out there on his own for a long time. And now there's a few of you out there. But I'm wondering... it kind of puts you between a rock and a hard place, I think, especially with the modern-day church, because, and this might get a little bit controversial for some people, but when you flip on the TV, most of the televangelists that you get out there, like, say, a Joel Osteen or what have you, are, you know, the big smiles and everything's great, and you can be this great, wonderful person and have this wonderful life, and it's sounds all nice and everything on paper, but they don't talk about the other stuff that we really need to talk about, and that's the dark side, because
right.
It really is out there, and the Bible, to me, is one of the most supernatural books that was ever written.
Oh, absolutely.
And so it seems like when you guys are going down that path, you're running into this where you might get a roadblock from the church and a lot of Christians out there, because they're like, well, you shouldn't be talking about that or writing about it. Are you glorifying it or what have you? And then you look over to the secular world, and they're like, well, we like to hear stories about demons and things like that, but you get a little too churchy for us.
Exactly.
Do you find yourself kind of stuck?
Oh, yes. I first wrote this book in 1999, and it took me 10 years to get a publisher to publish the book, and that's exactly the dilemma that I found myself in. The book, every secular publisher looked at my book and said, oh, this is a great story, but you know, you got some scripture in here. It's a little too preachy. I'm going, no, a sermon is preachy. This is a novel, okay? And then the Christian publishers were like, oh, man, this is really dark. You know, you've got some violence in here. You've got characters who may be unfaithful to their spouse or maybe thinking, you know, terrible thoughts. And I'm going, yeah, that's human. That happens every day. And so there really was this huge, it was what I call a crossover novel. It was stuck slap in the middle. Like you said, the Bible is a very supernatural book. It's a real book. It's about real people, real historical things. And they're not pretty. They're not happy. They're not, you know, there are terrible things that happen in the Bible that you go back and read them, and they smack of a horror novel. So it was a real challenge. And, you know, since I've written the books, I just pressed on and on because I really believe God wanted me to write them. One of the roadblocks I've run into is, like you said, in the church, people who go, oh, I don't want to read that book. That's about demons. That means I'm going to be worshiping demons. And I go, no, 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 wait a minute. I like one of my good friends is named John Steele, and he's the one that I based Jonathan Steele on, okay? I mean, because he's a bodybuilder. He's a strong guy. He played football. And so I kind of, when I pictured him physically, I could write about him. So I chose that name just so I could picture him, his physique, as I wrote about him. But I wanted him to read the book, and he said, oh, but it's about demons. I can't read that book. I said, why not? Well, you know, if I'll be giving myself into demons, I'm worshiping demons. And well, he was in the Army. I said, well, let me ask you a question. When you were in the Army, did they give you a manual, or did they give you any training about the enemy you were about to engage? Oh, yeah, we went into villages, and we practiced urban warfare, and we studied. And I said, did you study the customs of your enemies? Oh, yeah, how they dressed? Yeah, I said, so you're going to tell me that as a Christian whose bitter enemy is a demon, you're not going to learn anything about demons? You're going to ignore them like they don't exist? I said, that is classic enemy warfare. They don't want you to think about them. I said, you're buying right into their plan, which is let me fly below the radar. Don't read about us. Don't be aware of us. Smile. Everything's good. Everything's happy. And we'll be eroding everything underneath your foundation. We're going to destroy your world. And so, that's what I tell people. If you're a Christian, you are in the midst of a spiritual battle for the very hearts and souls of every human being that is alive on planet Earth. And if you don't understand your enemy, and if you're not willing and ready to engage the enemy in that spiritual battle, you are already defeated. And we can't afford that anymore, not in today's culture, which is going to hell in a handbasket as fast as it can. So that's what I tell people. And of course, that doesn't help sell the books any, but that's the problem. Like you said in the church, that's the problem you run into. Oh, this has demon on the cover. I don't want to put that in my church bookstore. Okay, all right. So it is a real problem. And my former publisher, Charisma, that I was speaking about earlier, formed their imprint, Realms Book. That was their vision, to promote just these kinds of books. And they had about a dozen authors, and they did a great job, but they couldn't. The bookstores didn't know how to market it. I mean, people come into Lifeway or some other Christian bookstore. Okay, where's the section on spiritual warfare and demon and supernatural thrillers? There's not a section. And so that was the problem is, again, the churches and the Christian bookstores didn't quite feel comfortable promoting these kind of books. So they got stuck in amongst 80 different Amish romance books. So here I am, a guy looking for a guy's book. Am I going to go look through the Amish romance to find the 13th demon? I don't think so. So I'm going to go back to Barnes & Noble and get one of the military books and, those books. I know they're going to give me the kind of thrill I need as a man. But then you get over there, and the Christian supernatural books are stuck in with the Christian fiction. And he's over there looking through the military horror books or the science fiction, and you're not going to see Christian fiction there. So it's really a big, big problem. And I have no idea how to solve it. I've talked to a lot of authors about it, talked to a lot of people in the publishing industry, and everybody scratched their head and said, we don't know how to promote these kind of books. So anyway.
I know it is, I'm sure, very frustrating. And what I'm hoping is, because you have such catchy titles, or I guess that they would be your subtitles, that it would kind of reach out to the secular community, and
exactly.
They would, at least if they have a hard time with some of the biblical stuff that you throw in there, would at least give it a chance. Because
if you
don't necessarily agree.
And that's what happened in my second book, The 12th Demon, The Mark of the Wolf Dragon, is about vampires. And I had more non-believers read that book than believers. And they sent me emails saying, I really enjoyed your book. You did a great job with the story, and I just want you to know you really made me think about the Christian faith. And I even had one email from a young man who read both the 13th and the 12th Demon, and his brother was an atheist and saw the books, and he said, "What are these about?" He said, "Well, they're about the supernatural," and so his brother read the books and sat down with his older brother and said, "You know what? I want to change my life. I think I want to become a Christian. How do I do that?" So there are non-believers picking up the books and reading them, and I try to make the Christian elements as non-offensive but as embedded in the DNA of the story as I can. The story has to have a certain foundation, and has to have blood and bones and meat that works and makes it move, and I try to make sure all of that is true to the Christian worldview. So intrinsically, if you buy into the story of the book, you buy into that worldview. And even if all that does is just give the reader a little bit of a question about, well, maybe I should look into this, maybe there's some truthfulness to this, then I think I've done my job. And I have a friend named Chan Heron, who is an apologist. He said, I like to put a rock in their shoe. I tell them something, it puts a rock in their shoe, and it bothers them enough that they go and they look in the shoe, and they go, oh, there's a rock there. So you want to give them enough of a rock in their shoe that they may say, well, let me go, maybe I should read the Bible. Maybe I should talk to somebody who is a Christian. Maybe I should investigate this spiritual component a little more. So,
sure. I mean, with these kinds of subtitles, I don't know, they're very intriguing to me. Altar of the Spiral Eye is your 13th demon.
Right.
You've got Mark of the Wolf Dragon, as you just mentioned, for the 12th demon. The Ark of Chaos. for the 11th demon, and the upcoming book is The Children of the Bloodstone. How did you come up with these titles? Are these yours, or did the publisher put those out there?
Oh, no, no, they're all mine. In fact, the publishers didn't like them, and I said, too bad. Put them on there.
I love it.
You know, they wanted to spell out the number. I said, no, no, you got to have a numeral because that big number is visually arresting you. And when people go back to look for my books, they look for the 13 and the 12 and the 11. So that's what I want them to look for. And the subtitle just gives you a little flavor of the book. And what I try to do with each, and this I'll cover this more in the next two books, but with each one of my demons, I try to have a symbol, like the spiral, the mark of the wolf dragon, and each, so there's a symbol that kind of ties in with their character, and that's always featured in the cover of the book in some way. I try to put that on the cover of the book. So on the 11th demon, there's a compass on the book. If you look, it's very subtle, but the Ark of Chaos, the original name was the Ark of the Demon Rose. And part of the story is, why was it called that? And it has to do with the compass and the compass rose. And it all makes sense once you read the book. It all ties into the Ark, and of course, hopefully the reader will make the connection that there's another Ark in the Bible that's not evil, and so this is the dark equivalent of that Ark. So, anyway, I'm laying the foundation for a future book, by the way. So, giving away some of my secrets here.
I'm trying to pull all these spoilers out of you. Look at me.
I know, I know. Well, the next book, the Children of the Bloodstone, that came from exploring the whole UFO concept, and of course I can say the word Nephilim. A lot of books have been written about the Nephilim, which is mentioned, or Nephilim, I don't know how you pronounce it. It's mentioned in the Old Testament. It's kind of a mysterious creature. Who was it? Are they real? And a lot, there have been several books written from a UFO perspective, particularly by Christian authors that embrace the Nephilim. So The Children of the Bloodstone ties in with that. There's something going on there with these UFOs and children. Are they, what's some unusual type of child? And the Bloodstone is, I'm laying the foundation with this concept of the Bloodstone for our spinoff series, which will be totally science fiction, called The Note of God. And at the end of the fourth book, you'll see a little epilogue that kind of leads you in that direction, and hopefully I'll have enough interest to write. I've already got those three books written as a trilogy. Hopefully I'll be able to get that science fiction series out there called The Note of God. But that's the reason the fourth book deals with extraterrestrials, UFOs, and outer space and all that fun stuff. So I'm giving you a little bit of a spoiler there, what that book's going to be about. That was a fun book to write because I've always been fascinated with UFOs and extraterrestrials, so that was a really, really fun. There's some monsters and creatures in that book that I couldn't sleep after I wrote the chapter. So anyway,
I'm really looking forward to that. That's a fascinating topic. Are you familiar with Ellie Marzulli?
I've heard that name. Yeah.
Well, he's the one. He's written books. His latest one was On the Trail of the Nephilim, and it's a lot of nonfiction. And he actually goes to Peru and looks at these, you know, skulls that they have down there that they're not human necessarily. So he does a lot of that stuff, and he's a Christian, so he does it from the Christian perspective.
I think I've heard about him in that book. So, I just use that in the fourth book. I kind of take it in a different direction. I don't really dwell on that too much, but let's just say that it may be, I may dwell on that more in the science fiction series if I get to write it. It lays the groundwork really for a whole new book series. So we'll see what happens with that. I've written the fourth book, and I'm really proud of it. I love it. It's my favorite of the four books. And when I was working with Charisma, they had a rule that all your books had to be 75,000 words. Well, my original fourth book, The Children of the Bloodstone, was 150,000 words. So I had to cut the thing in half. Well, now I'm free to go back to my original manuscript and re-expand it. So I've got a new edit of it that's about 120,000 words. And so I've written the book four times, you know, because I wrote it originally, then I had to rewrite it to as a book proposal. Then I had to rewrite it for 75,000 words, and now I get to go back to the longer version. So I've had the experience of playing around with four different versions of the book, and which is interesting when, you know, as a published author, I'm sure anybody who's been published can relate to that. You go in and you cut out scenes, you cut out whole characters, and so you know what could have been. You know what, oh, this, if you had just read this wonderful scene with this one character I had to take out. And so it's fun to be able to go back and resurrect that character and pull him back into the story that you'd originally thrown out. It's kind of like watching some of these extended editions of the movies, you know, where they add in 20 or 30 minutes of the movie. Sometimes that's a bad thing, though, but sometimes it's good, you know. So it's exciting.
Well, you know,
to be able
I've heard somebody point out something interesting about J.K. Rowling, and they said, you know, when you look at the original Harry Potter book, the first one that she'd written, it's not real thick, pretty thin, and then you get to the last few, and they're really, really thick.
Oh, really,
and they
long.
Said it just goes to show when you start calling the shots instead of the publisher telling you what you can and can't
write.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
you
look at Hobbit. You know, you look at The Hobbit, which is a children's story, and then look at what Tolkien did with The Lord of the Rings. I mean, you know, much deeper, much more involved, much bigger book. Anyway, I'm sorry I didn't mean to cut you off. But
well, that's okay. I was just going to say, why don't you give everybody kind of a brief synopsis of the two books that you've written before The Eleventh Demon, and then give us a little bit more of a broader synopsis on this latest book that you have out there.
Sure. The 13th Demon, The Altar of the Spiral Eye, introduces you to my main character, Jonathan Steele. And you kind of wake up with him on a beach, and he has no memory. He's been tortured. He meets a psychiatrist as he's going through his healing phase, and in that process meets a psychiatric patient who has a spiral around his right eye, and he says, I work with the 13th demon. Then terrible things happen, which I don't want to give away, but Jonathan Steele finds himself looking for this 13th demon for revenge. He wants to destroy it. And so in order to do that, he says, well, if I look for people who feel like they're oppressed or attacked by evil, and I may find this demon. So he starts to, he kind of makes himself a private investigator for God, so to speak, and he begins to get involved in people's lives. And in the 13th demon, he ends up in a small town where a church is being possessed by some evil presence. And he realizes when he arrives that he is finally, that this may be the 13th demon. He may have found him. And so that story is about this desire to uncover his past and have revenge, and yet he finds himself strangely drawn to helping people. And so he has to make a decision. Am I here for revenge, or am I here to help this pastor and his wife and this community escape from this evil presence? And so it's kind of that, you know, it's kind of a typical hero's journey. You know, it calls for a sacrifice, and so he puts together a team of a physicist, because weird things are happening in the church that are rooted in science, and he brings in a linguist because there's some weird language written everywhere, and these two people help him solve the mystery of this evil presence that's in the church, and it is linked to a evil businessman in this small town who wants to do some terrible things that will enslave the people of that town in evil. And that evil businessman is named Robert Ketrick. And then there's a link that ties it all back to human sacrifices in the Mayan and Aztec cultures. And so, and I'm not going to say much more than that, other than there's this big conflict at the end of the story that has to do with Robert Ketrick, the evil person, and Jonathan Steele. And Jonathan Steele prevails, and goodness wins over the day, but there are some terrible sacrifices that have to take place. And so he reluctantly finds himself in this position to where maybe I do need to help people. So in the second book, The 12th Demon, The Mark of the Wolf Dragon, he has to help this young teenager who's the nephew of his mentor, Dr. Cephas Lawrence, this older man who has a lot of interest in artifacts and evil, and he's researching demons. He kind of teaches Jonathan Steele demonology. And he has to help this old man with his nephew, the young teenager who's left over at the end of the first book, and he takes him to Dallas, which is the young boy's hometown, And when he gets there, he discovers that Vivian Darbone, who was the secretary and the administrative assistant of Robert Ketrick in the first book, actually is the kind of the evil force behind all of this. She's playing everybody. She's taken over this oil company from Ketrick. She's living in Dallas, and she's going to consolidate her power because she wants to be a member of this Council of Darkness. That's where you first find out about the Council of Darkness and the other 12 demons. And who shows up on the scene but the 12th demon from Eastern Europe? And he's a vampire, and he wants the territory of the 13th demon since he's gone. And so he wants to bring to life an army of vampires to take over the world. And so Jonathan Steele finds himself, bam, right in the middle of this conflict with with the 12th demon and the vampires and this teenage boy, Josh, who's an idiot, most teenagers are, pardon that, but he is, runs off with the vampire clan because his girlfriend's in it, so he ends up being a prisoner. So there's this big conflict at the end of the second book between a raven, as you mentioned, who is an assassin sent to kill Jonathan Steele, knows about his past. She's trying to kill him, and they end up in Transylvania. He's trying to rescue Josh from the 12th demon and these vampires, and you have this huge conflict at the end of the second book. So the second book is kind of like a James Bond movie. I mean, you know, it's got the big ending with all the bad people come together and the armies show up and the vampires are fighting. It's really, really, really big. And so by the end of the second book, Jonathan Steele has now, and his mentor Cephas Lawrence, he now has a new partner named Theophilus King, who ends up in the second book helping him. And they have to go back to Shreveport, Louisiana, and find a house for this kid to live in to protect him from these forces in Dallas. And they end up moving into, of all places, Robert Ketrick's old house, the bad guy from the first book. And that's where the third book begins, because in this house, this Robert Ketrick has many hidden secrets, terrible things hidden in his dungeon. And that's where this Ark of Chaos is hidden. And so naturally, the 11th demon now shows up and wants the Ark of Chaos. And so that's where the third book comes from. And the third book is really more about the consolidation of these four people as a team and a family. Jonathan Steele, Cephas Lawrence, his new partner, and, of course, the teenager, how they grow together as a family, how they really become a team to fight evil, and how Jonathan Steele accepts the fact that his role in life now is to fight these demons, you know, whether he likes it or not. And he still is going to find out about his past, but his goal is to fight evil. So the third book is about the 11th demon arriving, and it deals a lot with government conspiracies and how Satan moves behind powers and principalities like a chessboard, and whoever gets their hands on the Ark of Chaos will have control of the Council of Darkness and these 12 demons and can unleash chaos on the world. And, of course, Vivian is right in the thick of it. She's trying to get her hands on the Ark of Chaos. The 11th demon's trying to get it. Jonathan Steele's trying to stop them. And there is a fourth force in this story that surfaces, an evil force even worse than the Council of Darkness. So you realize there's more than just one group of bad people out there. So that was a long synopsis of all three books, but that's where the third book goes, picks up on the first two books. So.
Well, it's not that long when you consider. I mean, that was basically 5 minutes you wrapped up.
Wow.
I don't know how long they took you to write, but
and that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there's a whole sub story about Jonathan Steele and his father, and something's going on with him and the people in his past that's a running thread through the story that I can't touch on. And there's a whole sub story with Cephas Lawrence. You find out more about what drives him to explore evil, more about his past, and in the third book, The 11th Demon, The Ark of Chaos, you realize he has had, in the past, he's met the 11th demon 50 years ago, and he has not told anybody this. He has his own secrets that he's held kind of close to his vest. So we learn more about him, and it's really a lot about his story and how he came to be who he is. you find out that in the third book. Also in the third book, The 11th Demon, since Vivian Darbon is becoming my villainess, I've developed her through the first two books, you get a lot of her backstory. You begin to understand what drives her, why she is driven to get onto this dark council, why she wants to become a very powerful demonic being. You find out some of her backstory, and it's a very interesting story of how she becomes what she is. That she almost dabbles with normalcy in the third book. She's real close to giving up her lifestyle and becoming a normal human being. So I kind of play around with that in the book. So I really like the third book. It's one of my it was the most fun to write until I got to the fourth book. But just developing those characters and playing around with their histories and their personalities, I really enjoyed it. So.
Well, it's interesting that you went down the route with some of these creatures that, you know, have become really popular in the pop culture. I mean, you know, vampires. You've got the sparkly ones that come through on Twilight, and, of course, on TV we've got a lot of the, you know, they've made them into, I remember growing up, and you were supposed to be afraid of vampires, and now they're like these good-looking teenagers. It's like,
and, you know, and I kind of deal with that in the second book, The 12th Demon. They go to what's called a masquerade or a blood, kind of like a blood masquerade, and I play off all the new stereotypes of vampires and how far that is from the truth, you know, the traditional mythical vampire. So, in fact, the 12th Demon deals a lot with the history of the vampire myth and how it developed from ancient Romania like 2,500 years ago right up until through Vlad the Impaler into modern mythology. So I go into a lot of history there to build my story around. So it's kind of an interesting exploration of the myth of vampirism. It's not just I don't just plop them down with sparkly skin and and make them. I mean, you don't want to be a vampire after you read the 12th Demon. Let's put it that way.
Exactly.
You don't want to be that. No,
terrifying.
That's not something you want to do, which is the way it should be, in my opinion. So.
Absolutely. You know, when you talk about how they're trying to acquire the Ark of Chaos and the 11th Demon, is that kind of a playoff of the Ark of the Covenant?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Just right out there, I'll tell you, yes, it is. And and let's just say that's just the beginning of an exploration of the Ark, okay, both of them. So they're going to – that idea and concept is going to figure heavily in future books. So I'm going to chase after that for a little bit too. I mean, I'm trying to explore all the – you know, I'm looking at all of these interesting – Christian facts and also Christian, quote, myths, although I don't think the Ark of the Covenant is a myth. But you think about the Shroud of Turin, the Ark of Covenant, the Spear of Destiny. These are very typical artifacts that have been associated with the Christian faith, and they're also they've been used a lot in Christian fiction. So I want to explore the facts and the truth about some of that. Well, you know, was there a Spear of Destiny that was thrust in the side of Christ? You know, is there the Holy Grail? Is it out there? Can we find it? Is the Ark of the Covenant still around? I mean, and was the Shroud of Turin, was that real? You know, these kind of questions are always fascinating and interesting to people. And so I explore them myself, and I think they make very fun, what does George Lucas call them, the MacGuffin, you know, the thing that you're looking for in the movie. I think they can make interesting props in the story. So, but I always take them in a very unusual direction. So, I'm not gonna lead you into the typical story about the Ark or any of those objects. You're gonna see it from a very unique point of view because I'm not gonna do what everybody else has done. I'm gonna do something very different with it. So.
Oh, very interesting. The Spear of Destiny makes an appearance in my book as well. So I'll be fascinated to see how you have played with some of these things.
Yeah. Yeah, I went to Hampton Court in Surbiton, England on a trip to London back in 2009. And this is where Henry VIII kind of started his king. And he went to Hampton Court when all the plagues broke out in England, but there is a tapestry hanging in this room, and at certain times of the day, when the sun comes in the window just right, it totally changes. You know, it has a totally different appearance when the sun hits certain threads in the tapestry, and nobody really understands why it does that. It has something to do with ultraviolet light, the windows it's coming through. But, you know, that and there's supposed to be a hidden message to the church of in that tapestry, and nobody's ever solved the mystery. So there's all kinds of interesting things out there, artifacts like that, that just absolutely fascinate me. And I'd never heard of this tapestry until I actually sat in the room at that particular time of the day, and they put up an ultraviolet light to simulate, you know, the sun. They turned it on, and suddenly it's a totally different picture on the tapestry. It was amazing. So when I saw that, I said, you know, there are more things in this world than we can dream of, and what is that famous line from Shakespeare, but there's a lot of things out there hidden in plain sight that people have these conspiracies, these secret, you know, orders and organizations, and just exploring all that to me is fascinating. Talk about the Spear of Destiny, you know, the Holy Grail, the Knights Templars, and all of that. So I love it. It's fascinating studying that and then creating, writing a story around it. So,
you know, when you think about maybe some of your future writing as well, is there another, you know, after you get done with the first demon, I guess is what it would be, is there somewhere else that you would like to go on this journey of writing? Do you see yourself maybe starting up another series or some other route you'd be going?
Well, yes, I have probably a half a dozen different projects that I'm working on. One of them is a more grounded sort of a police procedural called the Shadow Merchant series, and the first book is written in, and the principle of that is the main character is a forensic radiologist. Of course, I'm a radiologist. Well, I wasn't aware that there are radiologists who specialize in forensic medicine, and you know they use MRIs and CTs and X-rays to help out medical and examiners. And so when I ran into that idea, and being a radiologist and knowing what goes on in the hospitals, I said, you know, I could write some really interesting stories. And so I've got a series. I've written three books in it, and I'm just looking for a publisher. It's called the Shadow Merchant series, and the reason it's called Shadow Merchant is I met a guy. A doctor from the military, and he called me. He said, "Oh, you're a shadow merchant." I said, "What?" He said, "Well, that's what we call radiologists in the military because you read these shadows on these X-rays all day, so you're a merchant of the shadows." So my main character is Jack Merchant, Dr. Jack Merchant. So I've got that series. I also have a series that we toyed around with publishing through Charisma, and it's still kind of in that limbo. Like we might do it, and it's called Death by Darwin. And it's a series about a young attorney who takes on very challenging cases that challenge the Christian faith. And the very first one is about a man accused of murdering his colleague, who's a paleontologist, over a statue of a dinosaur that he claims shows that birds evolved from dinosaurs. And because he's a Christian, they say, "Oh, you're a creationist, and this was, you know, you just wanted to kill, you killed your boss because you disagreed with him." And so this lawyer has to try to get him off the case. And so it explores this whole issue of creation versus science. So I've got two or three books in that series that I'm working on. And then I have a play that I wrote called The Homecoming Tree about World War II. I've converted it into a novel. And it's a very traditional, typical, kind of like It's a Wonderful Life type story. I'm looking for a publisher for that. And Jonathan Steele, when I get to the end of the 13 books, he's going to become a private investigator, and I'm going to take away a lot of the supernatural element. And I've already got two books that I've kind of outlined and written on in that series, just with him as a private investigator. And, of course, I've got this science fiction series, The Note of God, that I'm working on. So I've got about half a dozen projects other than the Jonathan Steele Chronicles that I would like to get out there. It's just a matter of finding a publisher that will accept them. And in today's Christian publishing environment, it's tough. It's tough to find somebody interested in doing anything but Amish romances and And I don't mean to pick on Amish romances. They're great. A lot of romance writers out there. That just seems to be really, you know, a very popular genre in Christian fiction. I'm even thinking about just forming my own independent publishing company and putting my books out under my own imprint. So,
Does that work?
Yeah.
Well, my gosh, your mind is amazing. I can't believe you got sidetracked with doing the whole medical school thing when you've got all those great ideas and all that writing that you've been doing. That's amazing.
My life plan was to be a doctor and then retire at an early age and write full-time. And that's still my plan. I'm in my 50s, and I'm trying to, over the next 4 to 5 years, make that transition and write full-time. And I think I could write 3 to 4 books a year. I've kind of got it down to a science. I think I could do that. So it could still happen, and I could spend the remaining decades of my life writing. That's kind of what I'm hoping to do. So,
awesome.
Anyway.
Well, I do want to let our audience out there remind you that we do have Bruce Hennigan joining us here. And if you would like to call in, you're more than welcome to do that. The call-in number is 347-945-7246. And we actually do have a caller joining us from the 561 area code. Who do we have?
You have Sandy Manning from the Boca Raton Children's Museum.
And Hi, how are you? Did you have a question?
Yes, I was wondering... we're trying to save our museum here in Boca Raton, and we do not wish to be just a recreation facility. We supply an awful lot of education to young children and so forth, and I just wanted to comment about that.
Well, you know, it's interesting
okay.
you say that, Sandy, because I was invited to speak to one of our local associations here in Shreveport, Louisiana. And I really had no idea what I was getting into, but it turned out it was the librarians, the school librarians. They have a local association, and they wanted me to come speak to them. And I was totally unaware of the fact that in our area in the state, they were going to completely defund school libraries.
Well,
and they were going to eliminate the librarians. That we don't need them anymore. We don't need all these books. We got the internet. And when I found that out, I was absolutely appalled. I was like, how can we turn our back on these traditional, these traditional pillars of community like libraries, museums? You're talking about a museum, and I shared with that group my own memories of growing up with a small branch of our Shreve Memorial Library next to our elementary school, and that for me was my salvation, being able to find books there. And we have, in Shreveport, we have a small museum that has been around all of my life, and it features a lot of the local lore, you know, like about our local history in Shreveport and Northwest Louisiana, and they've tried to close it so many times, and yet it's such, you can't do that. You've got, you know, I would agree with you and anybody that's listening, you've got to support your local libraries, you've got to support your museums. Any of these archives that remind us of our history and our culture, it's so vitally important. Robbie Zacharias is one of my favorite writers. He's an apologist. He has this saying that I write down all the time: the only thing worse than nostalgia is amnesia. And that's where, like, our museums remind us of the importance of our history and what we can learn from history. And in our postmodern culture that we live in today, nobody trusts history anymore. They want to rewrite it, and I think museums are so important for preserving that heritage. So I appreciate you calling in, and I totally support you. And, yes, we need to save your museum. So
thank you if you'd broadcast that and help us along, because we supply so much that's not supplied in the schools, hands-on, creative thinking, and so forth, and support our history and everything about our local area. So anything you can do to support the Boca Raton Children's Museum would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Do you have a website or something, Sandy, for that?
Yes, cmboca.org.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, and if anybody else would like to call in, if you have some questions for Bruce, the number is 347-945-7246. And just kind of going along with what you were talking about there, Bruce, I had heard a stunning story not too long ago where a teacher was trying to get the kids in the class to use their imaginations, And so she was saying, you know, imagine this and la da 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 da. And one of the kids raised his hand, and he had no idea how to use his imagination.
Oh, my goodness. Isn't that sad?
And I thought, you know, it kind of is reflective of the culture that we're in now because,
oh, I think so too.
You know, I remember as a kid, and we're pretty much the same age, that, you know, we had to use our imaginations. We didn't have all the CGI that they have nowadays and the video games and all the different channels to watch. And so we'd pick up a book, and you had to imagine what was in that book.
Right. And, you know, we were talking about J.K. Rowling earlier, but, you know, when she came out with the Harry Potter series, that saved children's books because children, there was this kind of this thought back in the late 90s that with the Internet and all of that, we don't need books anymore. And thank goodness that she wrote those books, and it was a renaissance in children's literature. And I think you're so right. I think in today's culture, children think, and parents are just as guilty as children, let me stimulate your imagination by exposing you to all these ideas. No, you don't want to stimulate it. You want them to use their imagination. You want them to use that brain to come up with creative ideas that not just flood them with somebody else's creativity. And I think that's what we run into. You know, our culture, it's so odd. We're at a time when you can see just about any kind of imaginative idea become real on the screen through CGI and movies, you know, and at the same time, we've got this huge vacuum in the ability to imagine things. And, I mean, just look at our movies. There are great movies out there, but so many of them are reboots and reboots and sequels and reboots. And I mean, this weekend, Spider-Man 2 comes out, and I'm thinking, we've mm-hmm. already had Spider-Man 2, and it wasn't that long ago. Why are we doing it again? I mean, hello. You know,
exactly.
The second Spider-Man was movie back in 2003 or whatever was pretty dang good. And you're going to do better than that. It's only 10 years, 11 years later, because we just don't have any imagination. So, and I'm a big fan of Marvel Comics. Marvel Comics was one of the things that I used to read when I was 13 that fired my imagination because it was a comic book. You couldn't hear them. You couldn't see them move. You had to imagine what was going on. And I think they've done a really good job of as far as the Avengers, Captain America, Thor, that's Iron Man, that storyline of using their imagination to create new stories. And you don't have to go back and reboot Iron Man. You don't have to go back and reboot Thor. They can take these stories and move on with them, whereas some of the Marvel comics, I think, are becoming repetitive and derivative and kind of a reboot. So, but you're right. I think it's scary that children don't know how to imagine anymore. You don't hand them a blank page and some crayons and say, draw. You know, you hand mm-hmm. them an iPad that already has a picture that you fill in or you change. And I think we need to give our kids, we need to go back to basics, give them blank pieces of paper, crayons and pens and pencils and say, come up with something, use your imagination, and let's see what you can imagine, what you can create. So anyway.
We do have another caller joining us from the 561 area code. Who do we have?
Hi, this is Dale Jones with the Boca Raton Children's Museum.
Oh, well, we just had Sandy on the phone with us. She called to talk about your museum.
Well, I actually was listening to the speaker that was just talking, and I absolutely agree with reading and how important that is to our children. And the example he gave about the Spider-Man movie was, I was thinking the exact same thing the other day. So I think you're absolutely right about that. And I think that, you know, we do a good job at the Children's Museum of making sure that we address that gap in what's happening with children and learning. So I just think it's great that your show provides a platform and a forum for those two entities to meet. So thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Well, thank you for calling in. We appreciate that.
All right.
Bruce, I want to get into the weeds here now when it comes to the whole process of writing, because obviously we have a lot of people out in the audience who are writers and getting involved in that. And you've mentioned that you have worked with the publisher Charisma, but I think originally you had done some self-publishing. Is that right?
That's right. I have I have dipped my toes in every kind of publishing you can imagine. So, yeah, I did. The very first book that I completed was a collection of children's plays called The Bible Adventures of Montana Holmes, and it was a series of children's plays that I wrote for my children's drama group, and it was based on a character similar to Indiana Jones. And I had a publisher contact me and said, I heard about your plays. We'd love to publish them. And it's Meriwether Publishing Contemporary Drama, which is a fairly well-known Christian drama publisher. So I said, sure. So they sent me a contract, and I said, we're going to pay you $300, but we're not going to pay you any royalties because it's our experience that the very first collection of plays never makes back that $300. So like an idiot, I signed the contract. Well, that collection of plays was at the top of their seller list for about 15 years. It was like, Why did I sign, that was a powerful lesson to learn. Well, then I thought, The second book I wrote was the book on depression that I mentioned earlier, and it was my pastor came to me and said, let's write a book on depression. So we wrote a book called Conquering Depression, A 30-Day Plan to Finding Happiness. And we knew an editor at Brahman and Holman that we had met at a conference. So we were in Nashville, and we just ran by his office and said, can we have lunch? And we were going to ask him advice on how to promote the book to find a publisher. We really didn't think B&H would be interested. And sitting down at lunch with this man, I had the book proposal in an envelope, and he looked at it and said, what's this? I said, well, that's what we wanted to talk to you about. We need your help in putting together a good book proposal on depression, because I suffered from depression, my pastor suffered from depression, and there's just no good books out there, and we want to write a book. And he looked at me and he said, you know, my wife's been depressed for a year and I can't find a good book. I'll take it. And I said, what? And literally, without promoting the book, we got a contract. So after that, I thought, man, this is going to be easy. Well, then I wrote The 13th Demon and spent 10 years getting it published. And in that 10-year period of time, again, we talked about this earlier, nobody understood the subgenre, the genre. Christian publisher after Christian publisher rejected it. Then I attracted an agent because of the Conquering Depression book. He shopped it around, and then I found out that he was a fraud. He never even sent the book out. Had to fire him. So I lost about 3 or 4 years there. And then I decided I'm just going to self-publish the book. I'm just going to get it out there and self-publish it, and maybe it'll catch the interest of a publisher. So the very first version of The 13th Demon I self-published through iUniverse, and it was a much, much different book from the book that is out there now. The book out there now is much better. So that was an interesting experience going through that self-publishing format. Now, that was back in 2006 when self-publishing was kind of on the cusp of becoming reputable. The 12th Demon, the second book, I self-published through an organization called Book Pros. I found them because I wanted to do marketing and publicity, and they had a publicity organization called Phoenix and Phoenix, and I was going to use them to promote The 13th Demon, and they said, well, you know, we also do self-publishing. Would you think about doing your second book through us? And I said, sure. And that was my best experience. Book Pros did a great job self-publishing The 12th Demon. And because of that, I met my current agent, and he said, you know, you've got this track record. You've got two books you've self-published. You obviously know what the publishing industry is like. And when you get your third book finished, we'll shop it around. And that's how I got Charisma. They read the third book, which is the upcoming book, The Children of the Bloodstone. And we went through about a 3-month negotiation phase where they said, we want to see the title of all 13 books. So I had to sit down and write a summary of all 13 books and the titles, and I had to tell them, you can't let anybody know this. I'm giving away my secrets here. And then they're the ones that said, now this book that you just wrote for NaNoWriMo, can you work that into the series? I said, sure. Of course, I had no idea how I was going to do that at the time, but you don't ever say no, you know. So then they gave me a 5-book contract, said, we want your first 5 books, and they went back and picked up The 13th and The 12th Demon, and we re-edited them, and I rewrote them, and went through the traditional publishing route. But then, of course, like I said, they had a downturn in their imprint, and I watched as fellow authors on the Realms imprint were getting let go from their contract, and I said, oh, they're getting next. I'm the only one left. I mean, there was only me and Mike Deloso. Mike Deloso is an excellent writer. He's one of their best writers, and so I knew they were going to hang on to him, but I said, oh, my goodness, they're going to let me go too. And sure enough, right before The 12th Demon was released, they said, we're going to let you go from your contract. We just can't continue to promote this imprint. It's just not selling. So I already had The 11th Demon and The 10th Demon written. So I met, I'm about done with this story, so hang with me. I met Michael Hyatt. Michael Hyatt was once the CEO of Thomas Nelson, which is probably one of the biggest Christian publishers in the world. I met him at a conference, and he was interested in the Conquering Depression book that I'd written, we had just found out at that point, it's another incredible story, that B&H wanted to update the book and wanted us to write an entire book series called the Conquest Series, but that has nothing to do with the 11th Demon, but that was exciting news. At least I had a writing future. But at the conference, he had heard about Conquering Depression, and I showed him my two books, The 13th and 12th Demon, and told him the story of Charisma. He said, oh, yeah, I understand. He said, look, you need to go back to self-publishing. He said, Westbow Press is a division of Thomas Nelson. He said, that's the future of publishing, is self-publishing. You promote yourself. You're in your own driver's seat. You can write the books as long as you want. He said, you know what you got to do. You got to have a good editor to help you get that manuscript as good as it's going to be, and that's where you need to spend your money, and you need to have good marketing and publicity. And if you've got a good story, it's going to sell. So I went with Westbow Press for The 11th Demon, The Ark of the Chaos, which is the one that's out now, the third book. And it was a similar experience to Book Pros. It was a good experience. Of course, when you self-publish, you pay for everything. So there's a pretty steep financial investment in the book. But if the book sells, you make that money back and more. And I was kind of promised that if the book sells, Thomas Nelson might consider picking up the series. So that's what I'm hoping and praying will happen, is that The 11th Demon will sell enough copies based on the first two books and the promise of the coming books, that Thomas Nelson will come and say, you know what, let's pick up all three books and you can go with us and we'll do the whole series. That's my dream. I hope that happens. So that's kind of my story of publishing. It's a very interesting, and it's all over the place.
But that's good, because you've had your feet in both worlds. And I've heard a lot of people have suggested that it is good to start off with the self-publishing route, and it's a lot easier to do nowadays, like you said, than it would have been years ago, because there's a lot of platforms out there where you can upload. We've got, of course, the Kindle and everything. Doing an e-book and stuff like that now is a lot easier. You don't have to worry about the expense of all the printing and all that other stuff. And then they kind of go with the same reasoning that you do. You do the self-publishing for a while, and if you can show, look, there's interest out here, I'm making some sales, then that's when the publishing company comes along and goes, we'd love to buy it.
I went to a couple of big trade meetings in the last couple of years, and there's two different numbers I've heard. 45% of book sales are digital now. And in the Christian realm, up to 76% of books are digital.
Wow.
And that's kind of scary. But where Christian bookstores make a difference is they're more than just where you go to find a book. There's there's other things there. It's a center for Christian culture, if you will, Bibles and trinkets and pictures and DVDs and resource books. So the Christian stores have done extremely well in today's environment, whereas the brick-and-mortar traditional bookstores like Barnes & Noble, they're not doing well at all. They are just, if you go into any of these stores now, half the floor space is taken up with games and promotions for movies and not just books. So the future of books is kind of really questionable. The good thing about self-publishing is if you just go with ebooks, it's a very low expense, very low investment, and you've got a good chance of selling the book through either iBooks or, you know, the Nook or the Kindle. The problem is with digital books is you can't walk into a digital bookstore and pick up a book and smell it and look at it and touch it. You know what I'm saying? I love to go to Barnes & Noble and just browse, just wander around. And if I see a book, I pick it up, look at it, read the first chapter. And I found so many good books by doing that. It's almost impossible to do that on the Kindle bookstore. You know what I'm saying? It's just, you know, you have to know what category. You have to do a search, and you can't just randomly at chance pick up a good book. You can't replace that bookstore experience online. But you can get published fairly inexpensively just through ebooks, and that's a good place to start. I would tell you from my experience in both genre, you know, both types of publishing, the key to making your book sell is you've got to spend money on a good editor, a good fiction editor who will take your manuscript and analyze it and tell you, look, these scenes are not working. Can I make some suggestions on how to improve them? And do more than just a line edit, which is a grammatical edit, but to actually say, here's how you can improve your story. And the first time I worked with an editor on The 13th Demon, I almost gave up. I almost said, man, I'm going to have to rewrite this whole book. But as I read through his 6-page analysis, and I'm going, you know, he's right. If I just tweak this, if I just do that, and it just opened up the whole world. And so the second book worked with the same editor. The process was much easier because I went back and re-edited that book before he got his hands on it. And so the editing process was almost like collaboration at that point. And there were things that I said, no, this is a good suggestion. I'm not doing it. That's not where I want to take the character. I think you made a good suggestion, but we're not going to do that. And so he said, well, I honor that. And I think the second book was so much better than my first. And so with the third book, The 11th Demon, I didn't even use an editor because I was trying to save money. I said, I'm going to see if I can learn from these first two editorial experiences and go back to this book. And so I did a rewrite of it. And when I had an editorial evaluation through Westbow, they said, you don't need any fictional or what they call substantive editorial advice. You've got this nailed. So you just need a line edit, which is where they go through and, you know, correct the grammar and the punctuation.
Sure.
So I think if you're going to do self-publishing, spend some money on the editorial process. I know people are afraid of that because you got to work with somebody, and they may not like your book. But if you go to some real reputable editors, and the best place to start is a book called Self-Editing for Fiction Writers by Elizabeth Browne, B-R-W-N-E. Fantastic book. It's been around for a long, long time. It's a paperback book, and if all you do is read that book and play around with the exercises, it'll make you 10 times a better writer than you were when you started reading it. And in that book, there's a website that they promote where they do editing, and my editor, Andy Meisenheimer, who I used, works with them. And so I'm a firm believer in getting some editorial input on your first couple of books. It's going to make all the difference in the world. It really is. So if you're going to...
Oh, that's some great advice.
Yeah, I mean, so if you're going to self-publish, instead of spending your money on fancy covers or going out and buying a whole bunch of marketing and publicity, spend it on your editorial process, because that's where you're going to learn a lot. Those editors are going to teach you a lot about your writing. You're going to hone your skills. And then when the traditional publishers come around, you can say, look, I had so-and-so edit this manuscript. And they're going, oh, that's $3,000 I don't have to spend. Not that that's what it costs. I mean, it varies. The cost varies. But if you've already been through an editorial process, that puts you way ahead of the game over 99% of the authors who send their manuscripts in, to be considered by a traditional publisher. So I think it makes a big difference. I'm a real big promoter of good editing. And you just have to be careful, because there's some editors out there that are scams. So, do your research and look at the testimonials. And if you find an editorial service that you like, ask them if you can talk to some of their authors. and send them an email and say, what was your experience? Did this person help you? Was this worth the money, you know, before you go out? Because it's going to cost you anywhere from $2,000 to $6,000 for that kind of edit of a novel. It's going to cost some money, but it's money well spent.
Very good. I agree with you when it comes to the actual book as well. I have resisted doing the digital thing. The only books that I've read in like PDF form or what have you are friends that I'm reviewing a book for them, you know, doing a first read on it or doing some editing. But I just, if I want to sit down and enjoy a book, I want the paper, I want the ink, I want the smell, like you said.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's also important, especially when it comes to a book, that you have a really good cover design, because that's what catches me sometimes with a book, is looking at a cover.
Absolutely. I mean, that is really, I was so, you know, my first two books with Charisma, I was so impressed with their cover designs. And then when I went with Westbo Press, they said, well, you have to design your own. And I went, what? Okay. So that the cover for The 11th Demon is, I came up with that myself. I still like it. It's not what I wanted. It's not what I visualized in my head. But I like it. I think I got the elements into the cover that I wanted. But you're right. You can pick up a book and look at the cover and know instantly whether this is a very poorly produced, self-published book. I mean, that's the cover will give you away. And you need to spend some money on that cover. Even if it's an e-book, that cover is still going to show up in the bookstore, you know. And I think it's very important. You need to get some kind of iconic look to it. That's why I use the 13, 12, and 11. I use a certain font, you know, to match so that each book has the same appearance with the font of the words. I use the same, the way my name is presented on the book. And like I said, I always try to have some symbol or some kind of graphic in there that it may be subtle, it may be subliminal, but kind of ties my books together. And then also, on my books, I have at the top Jonathan Steele Chronicles, and I have book one, book two, book three. I think that's important for you to be able to pick up the book, because a lot of people are confused by the numbers. Well, 11 comes before 13. Yeah, but I'm going backwards. So if I have on the book, this is book one, this is book two, this is book three, that very clearly helps you decide, well, this is the third book. Maybe I want to go back and read the first book. Although I'll tell people listening, every book stands alone on its own. You don't have to read the first two books to enjoy the third book. But I'm not going to discourage you from buying all three, you know, going back and reading the first two before you read the third one. But elements like that, I think, are important on the book cover.
Now, you mentioned that you have an agent, and you had a previous agent that turned out to be not what you expected. Would you advise writers to go out there and get an agent, and if you do, should it be before they start sending their work out to a publisher?
Well, that is, you know, in today's publishing environment, that question is a lot hazier. The answer is a lot hazier than it used to be. You know, 20, 15, 20 years ago, there was no question. If you had an agent, your chances of getting published were improved 1,000%. Because if you sent in an unsolicited manuscript, it went into the slush pile. Back in those days, of course, you had to print it out. You had to print the manuscript. And so they had piles and piles of paper manuscripts. Today in our digital age, it's a different ball game, and it's easier for editors to be able to screen e-book copies or digital copies than in the past. What I'm discovering in today's environment is there are a lot of small independent publishers out there who are looking for good writers. So if you don't want to go with a big name publisher, they're more willing to look at an unsolicited manuscript, and you don't necessarily have to have an agent. However, if you're going to look at some big name like Thomas Nelson or Zondervan or even Charisma, they're not going to consider you unless you have a query letter, which is just, you know, your first query, your first question of whether they're interested. That has to come from an agent, or they're not going to consider you. So we're kind of in a transitional environment where agents, I think, are very important today is in your contract. Because when you go with a traditional publisher today, it's no longer just that printed book that shows up in the bookstore. There's the e-book. There's the audio book. There is the what they call the enhanced book, which may be an e-book that has active links in it that takes you to websites or to additional content on the Internet. It's also movie rights. It's also television rights, YouTube rights. I mean, there's all kinds of digital rights out there that you have to make certain that you retain. And when you look at those contracts, and you know, I have no idea what I'm looking at. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a publisher. And so my current agent is Nancy Jernigan. Her husband, Jeff Jernigan, we spent one afternoon for 5 hours going over the Charisma contract, and he took 3 months to negotiate that contract because he wanted, you know, things like, okay, we're gonna produce T-shirts to promote your book. Well, he wanted to make sure that if they decided to sell those T-shirts instead of give them away, that I got part of the royalty. You know,
sure.
There are just little things like that that in today's publishing environment you don't think about, because publishers are not just book publishers. They're content providers. And the content is all over the place, DVDs, CDs, MP3s, iTunes audiobooks. There's so much content that could come out of a intellectual work that you produce. Your agent is the person that can make certain that you are protected with that contract. Now, with Westbow Press, since I self-published, the contract was pretty simple. Bruce, you retain all the rights to everything. We're just the agent of publishing for your book. You retain the rights for the e-book. You retain the rights. When if you decide tomorrow that you want to take this book and go with a different publisher, it's yours. So when you go with a self-publishing entity, that's the kind of wording you want in your contract. You want to make sure that you are the agent that owns all rights to your work. And that publishing entity is only serving as what is called the publisher of record. Their job is just to put it out there so that people can get it, but the rights to your work belong to you. So right now, do you need an agent to get published? I don't think you do, but it will certainly make it easy. Now, it's very hard to get an agent. It's harder to get an agent, a good agent, than it is to get published. I hate to tell people that, but it is. So,
okay.
I mean, it really is, because you have to send book proposals to an agent just like you do to a publisher, and then they decide whether they're going to represent you or not. And I went through getting my current agent, I had queries to two or three other agencies who said, no, we're not interested in your type of work, before I ended up with Hidden Value Group, who is my agent now. Now, what's interesting with Westbow Press and self-publishing, they had nothing to do with that. I did that all on my own because I didn't need them to represent me to Westbow Press. So they had no input. They had no connection to the third book whatsoever. That was totally and completely my doing, because in the industry, the agent gets 15% of everything that you make. And so I wanted to go with the self-publishing because I was attracted by the possibility of being picked up by a traditional publisher. If that happens, then I'll say, you need to talk to my agent, and y'all need to work through a contract, and let's get all these books. You know, I'll send them to the agent at that point. So,
sounds like a good plan.
Yeah.
When it comes to writing the point of view, I know with the 13th Demon and the 12th Demon, you do a third person, and you're inside all the characters' minds and that kind of thing. But
right.
You did something a little bit different with the 11th Demon, and I think this is intriguing since you did a book series. Usually people kind of stick with the same point of view all the way through, and you did something a little different. Tell everybody about that.
Well, that's when I did the NaNoWriMo exercise. I said, you know what, this is not, you know, the plan at that time, the book was just for me. I said, I need to learn, develop my characters better. If I write it in a first-person point of view as the character, then I'll be forced to develop an inner monologue, how they think, how they speak to themselves. I'll have to develop their, you know, how they look at themselves, how they feel about themselves. So if I do this, this will help me develop my characters better. So I took the idea of writing every scene using a different character of my five major characters, but write it from that character's point of view. And I loved it. It was just a lot of fun. But, you know, when you're reading the book, you have to say, okay, this, you have to, I had to put the person's name so they know, okay, this person's point of view, this is Jonathan Steele that I'm fixing to read, or this is Vivian Darbone, or this is Josh Knight, to make sure they knew that I was changing point of views. But I really enjoyed the experience. Now, the question is, what do I do with the upcoming books? Because the next book is written back in the third-person point of view. So I don't know if I'll go back to the first-person point of view or not for the future books. I have to decide that. My response from my readers has been very good. They really enjoyed the third book in the way that they get into the person's mind from a first-person point of view. And hopefully I've avoided confusion by putting the name so you know, okay, this chapter is going to be written from, okay, and I'm going to get into Josh Knight's teenager's head, which is a very dangerous place to be. But I thought it was fun. I had a blast doing that. So.
Well, and that's what's unique about it, because usually if people are going to go with, okay, I'm going to write this in the first person, it's the main character, and you just kind of are with that person, and what they're saying, you know, I did this, I did that. So that's what I thought was really unique about it, too, is you switch to, okay, now I'm going to write from this character's point of view, but it's not going to be third person. I'm actually going to be in
right.
there speaking
and,
as
I've read
them.
A couple, you know, I have a couple of my favorite authors. One of them is Robert Crace, and the other one is James Lee Burke. I've seen them do that in their books in a very limited way. They'll switch to a first-person point of view, a different character. Robert Crace writes books about Elvis Cole, who's a private investigator. He has a character called Joe Pike, and in a couple of his latest books, he goes back and forth between the two characters from a first-person point of view, but he puts their name so you know you only have two people to keep track of. And I said, well, I really liked that book. That's what gave me the idea. I said, I kind of like the way he did that. Let me see if I can do that with this book and make it work, but it's going to be with five people. That may not work. So that's, you know, from a logistic point of view, that was an experiment, and I kind of liked it. So I may in the future just use one or two points of view, but the problem, of course, with using one person from a first-person point of view is you can't talk about anything that happens outside of that person's personal experience unless there's somebody coming in and telling them, which is just pure exposition, you know, just, well, as you know, so-and-so did so-and-so, and I hate that in a book. It's just a huge stumbling block when somebody just stops and tells you stuff. You know, I strongly believe show, don't tell. I just went blank on that. I like to show it. I want to experience. Don't just tell me what happened. I want to live it. I want to be part of it when it happens. So that's the problem with using, I think, a single person's first point of view is you limit yourself in what's happening off stage, if you will, out of that person's point of view, out of his vision and sight and sound and senses. So now you can make it work, but it's a real challenge to do that. So
yeah,
what I
liked
about the third book, you know, the third book, The 11th Demon, I was able to get inside the mind of the demon. And I wrote scenes from the demon's first-person point of view. And in The 11th Demon, The Ark of Chaos, I talk about the fall. I talk about what happened when Satan was kicked out of heaven. And so my demon's point of view, you experience their frustration. You experience their sense of betrayal from Satan, their sense of loss, that they'll never be in the presence of God again. And being able to write that from a first-person point of view, it makes it so real. You almost feel sorry for the demon. I don't want you to feel sorry for the demon, but you almost feel sorry for him because you're experiencing as if you are that demon, as if you were the angel who was deceived by Satan and rebelled against God, only to be kicked out of heaven for all of eternity. So I really liked being able to do that because it makes the demons more than just a two-dimensional monster. It gives them some depth. Kind of helps you understand a little bit about why they do what they do and how they think. So, anyway.
That's great. I think sometimes people think if they're doing, you know, just a first person from one person's point of view or a third person from the main character's point of view, maybe it adds a little bit of mystery out there. But like you said, you don't want to tell the whole story. You want to show it to people.
Right. You can still keep the secrets and the mystery even from a first person point of view. By saying
sure.
things like, well, I could tell him what really happened, but I think I'll keep that to myself. And you go, oh, oh, well, he's hiding a secret. What is he talking about? When is he going to think about that so I can find out what that little secret is? So, you know, you can still, there's still ways to do that, and that's part of the craft. And again, a lot of that I learned through the editorial, you know, from my editor. So, again, I think that's a real help in writing these books and making sure they're coherent and cohesive.
When you're in that middle part of the writing, they kind of call it the middle slog. Sometimes you get writer's block.
Oh, yeah.
How do you deal with that and get past that?
Well, for me, it's I always get the beginning, and I'll write the beginning, and then I'll write the end, so I know where I'm going. And so now I'm stuck with the middle. And, you know, what do you do with that? What do you do with the middle? Of course, what you want to do in the middle is you want to raise the stakes. You want to bring the reader to a point of conflict where your character is either going to fail or he's going to grow. And you may have to have two or three of those. So for me, the middle is always about bringing my characters to that, to the really, really just crushing them, if you will. I mean, creating the most horrible conflict you can imagine, and then you back off some. So that to me is the middle is where you push them to the point where they've got to decide what they're going to do, and when they make that decision, that defines what happens in the end. And what I do, this is just old school, I have one of these giant Post-it note easels that, I mean, they're the size, you know, they fit on an easel, they're like, I don't know, 3x5, and I go and I write the character down, and I've got the beginning and the end, and I just do a timeline. Where is this character? How's this character going to get from point A to point T down here? And then I stick them all over the wall. So I'll have, you know, a dozen of these big, huge Post-it notes all over my study, and my wife just comes in and she just shakes her head and walks out. And so when I look at all of that, I begin to see how I can bring them through the middle. It becomes a journey. The middle is the journey. You know, the beginning is how it starts. The end is the destination. And suddenly you look at the middle as the journey, and you realize the journey is really the most important part of the story, because it's on the journey where you learn and you change. And so when you begin to look at the middle from that point of view, then it becomes exciting, and I can get over that writer's block, and I get real excited, and I can't write it fast enough. And the problem for me is I usually end up with two or three different alternatives that I can do in the middle, and it's choosing which path is true to the story. They're all going to get you to that same ending. They all start with the same beginning, but now I have to look at the story as an organism, as an entity, and which one of these middles fits the DNA of the story. And so it won't be contrived. It won't be forced. It has to flow naturally through the story. So that's kind of how I approach it. And so that's kind of my old school method, is getting out the markers and the easel boards and the giant Post-it notes.
Well, it sounds like you have a very interesting study then.
Well, I tell the story in one of my blogs. My son and his wife used to live in Austin, and my wife went out of town, and so I went down to Austin for a writing week, and I stayed in one of these bed and breakfasts, and I took my easel because I was working through the middle part of The 11th Demon, the book that's out there now, because I really wasn't happy with the way it was flowing. You know, it was just a quick book. But when I got there and started hanging stuff on the walls, there were all these weird, weird icons in this room. It was a living room and a bedroom. And there were phallic symbols and icons and goddesses. And I tell the story about waking up in the middle of the night with things touching my face and radios coming on for no reason. And I realized that I had all my Post-it notes up, but there were also demons in that place. And I had to pack my stuff up and leave because I couldn't finish the book. There was stuff happening every hour to distract me. I could not finish. It was like Satan was saying, you're not going to write this book, and I'm going to stop you. And you may think you're going to get this middle stuff figured out, but we're going to keep you from doing it. And and that stuff really happened. It was very frightening. And I ended up bailing out after about four nights, going back to my son's house and using his spare bedroom, sticking up my Post-it notes and finishing my story. So
Well, I think you lasted longer than I did. About the first time I had something brush my face, I'd probably be running out the door. I don't even know if the Post-it notes would make it with me.
Oh, man. Well, you know, at first you think, yeah, this can't really be happening. And then when I got up, I went and took a shower, and I walked out of the bathroom into the bedroom, and I just happened to look, and there's this full-length window, and the owner of the bed and breakfast was standing there just staring in the window like Norman from Psycho. I was like, ah! You know, had this weird look on it. I just kept waiting for the music, you know, and the knife and all of that. And that was my first clue that something wasn't quite right in this place. So, and the radio that would come on, and I swear this is true. People will not believe me. This radio came on at 3 o'clock in the morning playing big band music. And I went over, it was not plugged in and did not have any batteries in it. And I took it and put it in a drawer. An hour later, it was playing again. And I mean, that's when I, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I said, I'm out of here. And I packed up my stuff and left at 3 o'clock in the morning and didn't go back. So.
Yeah, that 3 o'clock in the morning is that typical time, too.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. The creepy hour, the witching hour, whatever.
Exactly. And, you know, anybody I hear tell stories like that, it does seem to usually be about that time of the night.
Mm-hmm. Although I'll talk about witches in my fifth book, so anyway.
That'll be fascinating.
Yeah, we go to Stonehenge in England in the fifth book. So.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting down towards the end of the interview, and I wanted just quickly for you to kind of tell people the message that you're hoping will come through in your books that would be relevant to, you know, a lot of the stuff that we're experiencing in the world today.
Yeah, what I try to do with my books is I want people to be aware that there is a spiritual side to our existence and that truth can be known. And, of course, as a Christian, I believe that truth is the God of the Bible and that there is real evil in the world, but there's really good. There's real good in the world. And we are in a struggle, and you have to choose sides. And even if you don't choose, that's a choice. And my books are ultimately redemptive. They have a very powerful redemptive element. The journey that you go through shows you that good can win out, but there may be a cost with that. And the cost is always tied to our choices. One word I use over and over in the book is choice with a capital C. Every person... You know, we can't blame the world. We can't blame our environment, our parents. Ultimately, at the end of the day, we make a choice about what we're going to do in life, what we're going to think in life, and it's our choice that we have to live with. And there's a way to make the right choice. There's a way. There's a way and a path towards truth that I believe is exemplified in the teachings of Jesus Christ that can help you have a life that's filled with joy and peace. It's not going to be easy. Like you mentioned earlier, the health and wealth, the smiling, everything's happy and joyful. I think if you're a Christian and that's your life, you may want to reexamine how close you are to fulfilling the purpose that God has called you to fulfill. Because if you're doing good in this world and you're fulfilling God's purpose for your life, Satan's going to try to stop you. The enemy's going to put everything in your path, and it's not going to be easy. So life is not easy. Doing good is not easy, but ultimately it is very rewarding. And so that's kind of the message of my books. That and the fact that there's truth there, there's evidence for that truth, and you can know that evidence, you can know that what you believe is truthful, factual, evidential, rational, and reasonable. It's not a fairy tale. It's not magic. Believing in the Bible is not believing in a fantasy. It's believing in something that's real. It reflects the whole reality of the universe because God created the universe. So,
and Bruce, I think where the books can people find out?
Well, right now you can go to 11thdemon.com. That's 11thdemon.com. 11thdemon.com is my website where I talk about the three books, where you can order the books. There's a link that takes you to a order page where you can get the e-book. I also have my own personal website, brucehennigan.com, where I write my blog, and I promote those books as well as my depression book, and there's tabs on there about my apologetic, my speaking ministry, other things that I do. BruceHennigan.com or 11thDemon.com. If you're interested in the books, go to 11thDemon.com. There's a way to order the books directly from the website if you're interested. If you'd rather have the ebook, I've got a link that takes you directly to the Amazon and you know, Barnes & Noble page and all that, where you can download the ebook in digital format. So both of those websites, start with the 11thDemon.com or check out BruceHennigan.com.
Bruce, I want to thank
you. And, of course,
so much
you can find my books in major bookstores if you can sift through the Amish romances. I'm sorry. No. You know, in the Christian fiction section, they're there because every time I go, every city I visit, I look in the bookstore and they're there. So you can find them there. You may have to get them to order one of them. They may not have all three, but you can find them in the bookstores. So.
Well, and that's key. You can always ask for them to be ordered at a bookstore.
That's right. That's right.
Well, thanks so much for joining me this evening, Bruce.
Well, thanks
it's been
for
a great,
having me. It's been a blast talking to you. So I've enjoyed talking about it. We could have talked more about Doctor Who and Hobbiton, but that's for another time, I guess. So.
Oh, my gosh. I have so many questions there. We probably could have talked for 3 or 4 hours because I have, like, conspiracies and all this other stuff. So we could have gone on and on, but thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. Have a great evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
I want to thank everybody for tuning in this evening. Again, I am your guest host, Diane Student. If you want to learn more about me, you can find me over at Twitter. My Twitter handle is Intrepid Student. And you can also find me on Facebook under my name, Diane Student. And I do accept most friend requests unless you're some kind of weird troll, and then I just stomp on you. Also, you'll be able to tune in to this show next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time with your regularly scheduled host, Daria D. Giovanni, and be looking in the future for my upcoming book, The Lewis Chronicles Book 1, The Shattering. Should have that out later on this year. And either route that I go, whether it's a publisher or self-publishing, it'll be out there because that's the wonderful thing about self-publishing out there nowadays. You can tell the publishers, well, if you don't think it's good enough, I do, so here we go. I also want to ask you guys to make sure that you support people out there who are some of your smaller writers, like Bruce Hennigan. As I said towards the beginning of the show, I have read the first two books. They're fabulous, and I know this third one's going to be great, so make sure you check those out and check out all different kinds of indie writers out there as well. You guys have a great evening. We'll talk to you later. Through the night.